welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning, everyone. Towns, villages, cities in Wisconsin, throughout the great Midwest, and nationwide. My name is Jim Santel. This is Morning Cannolis, and we are coming to you from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha, the Sha, 540 AM, 101 FM. This is our 11th show since starting these broadcasts in early June, and I am delighted. I'm honored that you've decided to spend some time with me this morning talking in weekend review about the important stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you with me and delighted to spend some time this morning talking in particular about some very significant cases, some significant events in the history of America just this past week. I'm joined in the studio this morning by my colleague and my producer, Calvin, and during the course of the next 2 hours, we're going to be taking your calls coming in at 844-967-2789. That number once again is 844-967-2789. We have an ambitious but achievable syllabus for you this morning, as we always do. A special program this morning, again, premised upon two significant events this past year in connection with the release of documents coming out of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., as directed by courts of the federal government. We'll talk about that more in just a moment or so. We're going to be spending most of our time today focusing on what those two documents mean, what their import is, and at the end of our second hour today, I'm going to spend some time with you talking about the reasons why these events of this past week are very important, the conclusions we draw from these particular documents, even after we spend some time in the next 2 hours talking about their content, their import, why they're right, why they're wrong, and the things that all Americans we should understand about these two important releases this past week. Before we get to all of that, I want to spend some time commending once again my lead-in colleague, Don Brown, who does This Week in Waukesha so very well. Once again this morning, coming to you from the farmer's market right down the street here in Waukesha. Beautiful, sunny morning, a Saturday morning here in Waukesha. Don was my invited guest to be here this morning, and because of the importance of the matters we're going to be talking about, these two issued documents, I've asked Don to come back next week, Saturday, September 3rd, when we can spend a lot of time talking about issues here in Waukesha, in Wisconsin, again, throughout our nation, so we've got enough time to engage in the kind of banter and discussion that Don is so very good at. We started that last week on his show, promised he'd be back here this weekend. Unfortunately, because of the content of today's show, anticipating your phone calls and also lots of things to talk about, I've asked Don to come in next week as opposed to this week, and we'll very much look forward to that, as we will to his broadcast next Friday and then again next Saturday from the farmer's market here in Waukesha. As always, this is a review of the important stories in law, in government, and aspiration for justice in America. We begin this morning, as always, talking about things in history, things that happened on August 27th in the history of our world and the history of our nation. This is the 239th day of the year of 2022. There are 126 days remaining on your calendar. Eight very significant things in the history of our lives and the lives of people who preceded us that happened on August 27th in the history of our world and in our nation. In 1859, in this country, in a place called Titusville, Pennsylvania, the first time the petroleum was discovered under the ground, and that produced the world's first commercially successful oil well in 1859. We know how significant that was, not only in connection with motor vehicles, but many other things coming out of the commercial sale and development of oil products. We know that remains a highly, highly relevant issue. Even as this past week, California announced that in just a few short years, it's going to prohibit the sale of gasoline-powered cars in that state. But 1859, petroleum discovered in the ground for the first time in Titusville and the world's first commercially successful oil well at that time. 1908, a few years later, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who would go on to be the 36th president of the United States of America, was born. He was born on this day in 1908. Another significant connection to recent events, he died on January 22nd of 1973 at the very young age of 65. That was the same day that the United States Supreme Court issued its decision, now overturned in Roe versus Wade. But in 1908, on August 27th, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the 36th president, also the president who signed major civil rights legislation in the history of our nation, born on this day in 1908. 1928, a couple of decades later, the Kellogg-Briand Pact. What did that say? Well, it was a work put together by the Secretary of State of the United States Department of the State and of our nation and the Foreign Minister of France, a fellow named Aristide Briand. Frank Kellogg got together and put together a pact, a document that did what? It supposedly intended to, good intentions, to outlaw war after World War I. It was signed initially by 15 countries, including Germany and France and the United States. Eventually, 61 nations signed off on it. The intention to prohibit war on the face of this planet. As we know, a wonderful aspiration, plainly an aspiration not realized, as just a few years later, World War II breaks out, and we know about the history of the 20th century and the 21st century involving wars across our nation, including those that continue to this very day. Other events in the life and livelihood of our time. 1962 was the day that the Mariner 2 unmanned space mission was launched to Venus. Venus, again, recently in the news because many scientists are looking to Venus to re-examine whether there's a possibility of life out there on that second planet. But Mariner 2 in 1962 launched to the Venus planet. Interestingly, it was also on this day in 2003 that Mars, just beyond us in the opposite direction, made its closest approach to Earth in some 60,000 years. August 27th of 2003, Mars comes as close to the planet Earth as it has been in 60,000 years. For those of you keeping track at home, that's about 35 million modest miles distant from our place of life. That happened in 1962. Something more lighthearted, in 1964, Mary Poppins, the original Mary Poppins, had its world premiere in Los Angeles. The screen debut of a young star named Julie Andrews in 1964. Other significant things on that date. 1979, very serious story, a very serious time in the British Isles, and in particular Ireland and Northern Ireland, the time of what's called the Troubles. 18 British soldiers were killed in an ambush on this day in 1979 by the Provisional Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland. That was one of the deadliest attacks ever in that many years-long conflict in that part of the world. On the same day in 1979, August 27th, an IRA bomb killed British royal family member Lord Mountbatten and three others on his boat in Ireland, called the Troubles, in 1979. A couple of other events in 2008. On this day in 2008 was the day that a senator from the state of Illinois named Barack Obama was nominated by the Democratic Party as its candidate to assume the presidency of the United States of America. Of course, as you all know, he would go on to defeat John McCain in the general election later that year and stay in office for 2 years. I was honored during the course of his term to be nominated by him and confirmed by the United States Senate to serve as United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin during that term of Senator and then President Barack Obama. And finally, a very sobering event in 2011, not that long ago. 2011, August 27th, was the day that Hurricane Irene made landfall in the United States, in North Carolina in particular. The Outer Banks and the Eastern Seaboard hit dramatically, catastrophically by Hurricane Irene. Damage of more than $15 billion with a B dollars. One of the most expensive disasters in American history, killing nearly 50 people. On August 27th of 2011. A whole series of events, again, significant events happening on this day in history. As I indicated, our agenda today is serious. It is ambitious, and we again invite your phone calls along the way at 844-967-2789. Calvin is going to be working with me in getting your calls in. We've got a lot of things to talk about in connection with these two big news stories of this past week. The first one of them happening on Wednesday, the second just yesterday, in our nation, coming out of our nation's capital on Wednesday, at the direction of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, following some review, lots of litigation by a lower court, lots of litigation by attorneys at Main Justice and in the courts of the District of Columbia. The federal courts ordered the release of a memorandum that was issued 3 years ago, put together 3 years ago by officers of the United States Department of Justice and something called the Office of Legal Counsel. And why is this memorandum important? Why are we talking about it 3 years later? Well, again, I'm going to be spending a lot of time at the end of our second hour chatting about why both of these things that happened this week are very, very important in our history, not just to know about today, but to know about for all time. This particular memo, dated March 24th of 2019, now over 3 years old, was issued at the time to describe to then Attorney General William P. Barr a basis for coming to conclusions about the Mueller report. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time this morning giving you some history, some background of what that was all about. And I'm going to give you a warning that in connection with my assessment and the assessment of many other people, the memorandum that we're going to be talking about today, now finally released, directed to be released by the federal courts, is, in the words of a very learned commentator and many others who've taken a look at this 5 or 6 or 7 page document, flat out wrong on the facts and the law. A stunning memorandum to be released today, but important in understanding the history of 2019. When William Barr, the then Attorney General, described for the first time what the findings of the Mueller report were all about, premised in part upon this memorandum, changing forever, I would argue, the narrative history about what the Mueller report does and does not say. I'm going to talk more about that significant memorandum when we come back right after the break. Once again, this is Morning Cannolis, sampling the news desserts of this week. This week, including two very important documents coming out of the United States Department of Justice. Join me. And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis. We're talking this morning about two very important documents released this past week on Wednesday and again just yesterday on Friday by the United States Department of Justice with the authorization and the direction of federal courts in the United States of America. Right before the break, I began to chat about this memorandum written to then Attorney General William P. Barr describing the Mueller report. For those of you who are planning your morning, in our second hour beginning at 10 o'clock this morning, the second hour of Morning Cannolis, we're going to turn to the significant event, the release of the document yesterday, the supporting affidavit that justified probable cause to enter into the premises of Mar-a-Lago, the former president's residence and office. We're going to talk about that document. And then at the end of the day, we're going to be chatting about the reasons why these two documents are not only important, but how they're connected and the direct relationship between them, the importance of history and beyond that. Again, we are encouraging you to join us at 844-967-2789 as we launch into right now this discussion of this very significant memorandum that came out of the United States Department of Justice just this past Wednesday. Let me go back and do a little bit of history on this, some of which you probably know, virtually all of which you probably know, a little bit of detail around the edges as well. You may recall well that Rod Rosenstein, who at that time was the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America, the second in command, Jeff Sessions was the Attorney General of the United States of America, the Chief Federal Law Enforcement Officer for the entire nation. At that time, there had been sufficient reason inside the Federal Bureau of Investigation to be concerned about whether or not there was Russian involvement in the 2016 election. Recall that well. And as a result of that, Rod Rosenstein, again in his position as the Deputy Attorney General, decided to commission a report, an investigation leading up to a report, determining whether or not there was indeed some connection between Russia's involvement in our election, the results of it. Were they meddling? Were they involved in some way? And that's what gave rise, ultimately, I'm skipping over a fair amount of significant information here, ultimately to the appointment of a fellow named Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller, M-U-E-L-L-E-R. Mr. Mueller had previously served as the Deputy Attorney General. He was a United States Attorney in San Francisco for many years. He was the director of the FBI prior to that time, and he was pulled out of retirement to determine whether or not, again, there was this connection between the Russian involvement in our nation through social media, through various companies, other things, and the 2016 election, commissioned once again by the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. And in the wake of a years-long investigation, most of which, virtually all of which, was not in the public domain appropriately, Bob Mueller issued a report. It's nearly 500 pages long. It's a lot to consume. And it is, as I've often said on this wonderful radio station, it is in many ways a prosecution memorandum. It's a description not only of what he found, but also about the bases upon which a prosecuting authority or on Capitol Hill, an impeaching authority could bring a case against the former president for obstruction of justice. Before even getting to that, however, Robert Mueller divided his report into two major sections. The first one focusing upon his principal assignment from Rod Rosenstein. That first portion of the report determining in the end that while there was parallelism, there was a certain amount of symmetry. There seemed to be not direct connections, but an awful lot of awareness of each other, the Russian entities that were the focus of the Mueller investigation and the Trump campaign did not, in fact, conspire. No reason to believe, based upon what Mueller put together, no reason to believe that there was a formal conspiracy and agreement between them to undermine the election. And that's a significant finding. And that's exactly what the report said in the first 200 or so pages of it. There was an awful lot of discussion at the time about this word collusion. Robert Mueller went to great length to explain rightly, accurately, that collusion is not a term of legal art, that rather the question is whether or not there was a conspiracy. And again, he found there was no factual basis, there was no legal basis to conclude that the Trump administration had indeed conspired with Russia in its individual capacities or generally to undermine, to affect the 2016 election. That's the first portion of the Mueller report. The reason why the events of this past week are so important is because we focus then upon the second, also 200 pages of materials in the Mueller report. And what did Bob Mueller go on to do? As part of the broad commission given to him by the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, Bob Mueller went on to catalog, to describe and to detail in great detail the specific instances in which the now former president, then sitting president, Donald Trump, had attempted to obstruct the investigation of the Russia inquiry itself. In other words, during the course of that investigation, were there things that the former president, while he was in the Oval Office, in the White House, did to try to stop that investigation? And again, over the period of about 200 pages or so, some of which we'll talk about this morning, only because it's relevant to this memorandum, during the course of that 200 pages of findings, heavily documented, specific references to people talking about specific events, things said by the presidents, things said by people around him, documents and other strong indicia of obstruction of justice, Bob Mueller identifies 10 10 particular instances in which a prosecutor or an impeaching authority might find that there was obstruction. And he releases this report, and he says significantly that the reason why he is not and cannot recommend a prosecution of the president based upon what he's identified as 10 of these instances of obstruction is that there exists, as we have talked about in great detail, a memorandum inside the Department of Justice that prohibits the prosecution of a sitting president for crimes. It is not a statute. It's not a constitutional mandate, but it's been around for about 20 years in the wake of Watergate and other events in American history. An office called the Office of Legal Counsel, once again coming back to the issues of Justice Week, issued this memorandum saying, you know what, you can't prosecute or you should not prosecute a sitting president. And so Bob Mueller said, you know what, I can't do it based upon what I've found. And an awful lot of people, including me, believe that what Bob Mueller did instead was to author a report to be presented to the Congress to determine whether or not it should impeach on events that the Department of Justice could not prosecute on. We know the history there, which is that there was not a choice to impeach on these issues. Nonetheless, a compelling report about obstruction of justice. And along the way, prior to the release of that report, and this gets us to the specific memorandum of this past week, Bill Barr, before the public announcement of it, came forward and did a couple of things. He issued a letter, a four-page letter to Congress, and then talked publicly to the American population about what it said. Right after the break, we're going to tell you more about what he said at the time and the basis for that report to America, to Congress, from this memorandum. Join us right after the break as we get into the meat, the heart of this memorandum of this past week. Welcome back. Good morning. Once again, this is Jim Santel reviewing with you this morning the events leading up to the announcement by the former Attorney General, William Barr, about what was and was not in the Mueller report, this compendium, this 500-page document issued by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, the former director of the FBI, former U.S. attorney, making findings about what happened in connection with the Russia involvement, if any, with the 2016 election. We know there was a lot, but not in particular relationship with the Trump administration, and more importantly, focusing upon obstruction of justice. Robert Mueller, as I said before the break, identified 10, probably 6 to 8 of these prosecutable instances where the former president engaged in conduct in the nature of obstruction of justice. And so this report gets delivered to the Attorney General way back on March 22nd of 2019. It is not yet released into the public domain. And two days later on March 24th, the Attorney General releases a four-page memorandum, a four-page letter to the Congress in which he basically says that, yes, with respect to Russia, nothing there to see, no conspiracy, which is accurate in terms of what the report said. But then he goes on to say, oh, by the way, I and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, have also reviewed the report and determined there is no basis upon which to prosecute the former president, at that time the president, for obstruction of justice. And it is that report, that finding, if you will, that representation repeated on the very day, on April 18th, when the report was finally publicly released to all of us, to all of you, to the Congress, to everyone else. It is that second finding that the report does not, in fact, support a finding, a predicate for prosecuting for obstruction of justice that was the focus of so much attention and so much focus. Why? Because those of us who did, and I suspect many of you have read, if not the entire 500-page opus, lots of it, you come away, you are absolutely convinced, based upon Bob Mueller's assessment, that there are instances, many of them prosecutable, of obstruction of justice. So this complete disconnect, if you will, between what the Attorney General had written and what he had said days after, 48 hours after getting this report to the Congress and to the American public, a narrative that I would offer remains to this day. People believing that with respect to both portions of the Mueller report, there is no finding. There was no finding of obstruction of justice when, in fact, Bob Mueller had said just the opposite. Bob Mueller would go on in July when he was testifying before the Congress about this to explicitly say that what the Attorney General had reported was not accurate. He went on to say that is not what a report said. He wrote to the Attorney General shortly after the Attorney General was announcing these things and said, you have misconstrued what we said. You have not accurately described what my report says. And so he took him on directly, but nonetheless, the narrative took hold. And the question that comes from all of that history is, where did the Attorney General get this notion that the report, contrary to what he said and contrary to what every single analyst out there who's honest about the report has reported on it, where did he get that notion? Where did that come from? Well, it turns out that, and we've known this for a long period of time, that the Office of Legal Counsel, an office inside the Department of Justice, in particular the staff there and two of the assistant attorneys general inside that office, had authored a 7-page memorandum internal to the Department of Justice given to the Attorney General within hours, if you will, after his receipt of the report and prior to his announcement about what this report said. And it's that memorandum, that 7-page memorandum that was finally released this past week. For a number of years, many years, frankly, 3 years, the Department of Justice under both administrations had declined to release this internal memorandum on the basis it was deliberative in nature, that it was the result of the back and forth, the discussion being had. And in the end, a district court judge named Amy Berman Jackson in Washington, D.C. said, you know, I'd buy that if there was truly some deliberation. The problem with this is that this memorandum basically codifies a decision already made. And that's one of the first points that you pull away from the memorandum when you read it now, that as Amy Berman Jackson thought when she reviewed the memorandum, this is not the result of a deliberative process. This was a result of being directed to justify a decision and provide behind the scenes, if you will, explanations for what it is that the Attorney General was saying. And so just this past week, the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit affirmed Amy Berman Jackson and said, nope, Department of Justice, you got to release it. And so the Merrick Garland, the present attorney general, did just that. What does this memorandum say? What does it reveal about the Office of Legal Counsel under the Barr administration? And what should we take away from it in terms of meaning? Well, a number of different things. First of all, comes to the conclusion that the evidence described in the second portion of the report is not, in our judgment, according to the Assistant Attorneys General, Office of Legal Counsel, who wrote it, sufficient to support a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that the president violated the obstruction of justice statutes. And goes on to describe in the following pages the bases for that. I'm going to spend some time in the remaining moments of this hour talking with you about the reasons why that report, again, is inconsistent with what Bob Mueller said. It is inconsistent with the law and inconsistent with the facts as they're set forth in that volume. A stunning memorandum that, again, is accessible, should be read if you have the time, by all Americans who are interested in these kinds of things. Along the way, the authors of the memorandum said, you know, even though the special counsel himself chose not to make a specific prosecution decision here, we're going to do that. And so recommended, and the Attorney General did choose not to prosecute at all. Along the way, saying this, while cataloging the actions the president took, many of which took place in public view. Again, a first interesting comment that somehow the fact that many of these obstructive acts were in the public view, that makes a difference. It does not. It does not under the law, but nonetheless highlighted by the authors of this memorandum for the Attorney General. The report identifies, they say, no actions that in our judgment constituted obstructive acts done with a nexus to pending proceedings with the corrupt intent necessary to warrant prosecution under the obstruction of justice statutes. And then they go on to talk about the bases for that particular finding. Let me identify two or three of the fundamental errors in law that many people have identified in this memorandum. Shocking, stunning, surprising, coming out of the Office of Legal Counsel, which is supposed to be this office inside the Department of Justice that provides information, candid information, direct information to the Attorney General so that he or she can make appropriate decisions about policy and prosecution. Listen to what the folks who wrote this memorandum say. They first of all begin by saying that there's no precedent for this, that there's nothing that we can identify in the law, in the past history of cases that would support this kind of prosecution. They cite a couple of cases, but indeed, along the way, they fail to acknowledge that there are all kinds of justifications for precedents that would support prosecutions for this kind of thing. It is common for people to look at this memorandum and say today that if you and I, if other people, not the President of the United States of America, were to engage in these kinds of prosecutorial, rather obstructive events, we would in fact be prosecuted. And in fact, the notion that there is not a precedent for this is simply belied by tens, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 years of history of prosecution in America. More significantly than that, listen to what the memorandum says about the predicates for a prosecution for obstruction of justice. They say this. Given this conclusion, the evidence does not establish a crime of criminal conspiracy involving the president toward which any obstruction or attempted obstruction by the president was directed. It would be rare for federal prosecutors to bring an obstruction prosecution that did not itself arise out of a proceeding related to a separate crime, a separate crime. And so what does that mean? Why is that also very, very important? They're talking about the notion that in order to prosecute for obstruction of justice, you've got to have an underlying offense conduct. That is, you have to have found, in this case, that the president engaged in a conspiracy with the Russians before you can charge for obstruction of justice. And that, as anyone who knows these kinds of things, who's prosecuted cases in federal and state forums, that is simply a misstatement of the law. And I would offer that the authors of this, high-level people at the Office of Legal Counsel, know better when they describe this. It is an impediment to bringing a prosecution of the president based upon this notion that he was not, in fact, found reliable, or found responsible, rather, reliably responsible for the events itself related to Russia. That is the first of several problems with this memorandum. Again, this notion that you need a predicate offense conduct, a finding of that, maybe even a conviction, before you can charge for obstruction of justice. Plainly not the case, as many people have observed. How could that possibly be? If you're successful in obstructing justice, there will be no finding. We'll talk about some other problems with this memorandum in our last few moments of this hour into the next hour as we're chatting here on Morning Cannolis about this memorandum coming out of the Office of Legal Counsel 3 years ago, just released this past week. Once again, talking with you, involving you, if you wanted to call in at 844-967-2789 about the significant problems with this memorandum issued 3 years ago, just about in the spring of 2019, suggesting that there was nothing in the Mueller report in the nature of obstruction of justice that would support a prosecution of the president. The premise, the theory, the advocacy this morning, not just from me, but from many other people have looked at this memorandum, that the memorandum itself rife with problems legally and factually. Right before the break, I expressed this concern that somehow the fact that some of these events happened in the public domain made a difference. They do not. That there was no precedent for this, according to the memorandum, also not true. An awful lot of precedent out there for prosecuting someone who is engaged in this kind of obstructive conduct. And then talking specifically about this notion that in order to prosecute anyone for an obstructive event, you need to have an underlying crime that has been known, been identified, perhaps even beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, simply a misstatement of the law, contrary to policy, contrary to practice, contrary to common sense. Another problem with the memorandum as it's set forth, as we've now received it this past week, discussion about how many of these events did not, in fact, result in anything specific, that they were attempts. They were attempts to engage in underlying obstructive acts, but they were not successful. The president directed other people to do things and explained that they should do things on his behalf. They didn't do them, and because they did not go forward, or the events themselves did not result in obstruction, that is a reason for or change in the findings of the underlying case. That is a reason for finding that the obstruction did not happen. What is the problem with that? Once again, a misunderstanding of the law, fundamental law coming out of law school, criminal prosecution, that attempt in and of itself is a crime. You do not have to consummate, you don't have to achieve the crime itself, whatever that might be. And it is simply a misstatement of law in this memorandum by these folks in the Office of Special Counsel that in order for the former president to have been prosecuted, they had to have been successful in undermining the underlying investigation. Not true. An attempt is significant. An attempt is a crime in and of itself. And then there's also some additional language that is concerning. Discussion about how the president's conduct here was not motivated by any ill intent, by any malpurpose, but rather was simply the product of some political interest to avoid personal embarrassment, as the report says, personal embarrassment, public focus. And that if that is the case, that because of personal embarrassment and political concerns are the motivation for your engaging in conduct, there can be no prosecution for obstruction of justice. Once again, a fundamental misunderstanding, a conflation, if you will, of motive and intent. You can have many motives that could be well intended. Politics could be one of them. Avoiding personal embarrassment could be another. But you can still have the intent, therefore, to violate the law. That is a fundamental principle. First year, second year law school, prosecutors around the country know that well. The mere fact that there may be a motive premised upon politics, or as the memorandum says, the president concerned about the cloud on his nascent, his early administration time at that period of time, this is early 2017, that's his motive, and for that reason, the intent could not possibly support a prosecution for obstruction of justice. Today, I will offer to you, as I have with respect to these other points, that is simply a misstatement of law. And the assistant attorneys general, even as they are writing this memorandum, have to know it. They make reference during the course of this memorandum to something called the Principles of Federal Prosecution, which is this publicly available set of guidelines that provide policy and direction, all sorts of legal standards as well, about the bases, the reasons why prosecution is undertaken, and the practical approaches as you go forward and prosecute someone for violations of federal criminal law. It is fundamental in those principles that these notions about predicates, about attempt, about motive versus intent, all of those are implicit, if not explicit, in the very principles of federal prosecution that the authors of this memorandum invoke to support a finding that there is no basis to go ahead with a prosecution of the former president for obstruction of justice. Huge problems with this memorandum called to the attention of Americans generally in the past 3 days as this has broken loose. Beyond that, beyond the misstatements of law, lots of misstatements of fact as well. And Bob Mueller, as I indicated earlier, both in testimony to the United States Congress and in letters written to the Attorney General himself, contemporaneous with the Attorney General then coming around and saying, based upon my advice from the Office of Legal Counsel, I'm not doing anything with this. There's no predicate for prosecution. The other problem that Bob Mueller himself identified was a misstatement of fact. And indeed, the memorandum spends a lot of time talking about some of these specific events, including, for example, the president's directing Don McGahn at the time to author some made-up reports about whether or not the president had directed the firing of the FBI director, asking the Don McGahn to deny newspaper reports that the president had directed him to fire special counsel in particular, making up reports about those kinds of things. And because of the focus of that, among eight or nine other instances, the authors of this memorandum, this internal document to the Attorney General at that time, find that indeed there was nothing wrong there, that the events as properly interpreted cast significant doubt on whether or not, as they say, the president actually sought to induce Don McGahn to lie. I have to believe that Bob Mueller today, if he's reading this memorandum, which he may or may not have seen previously, and recalling his investigation of the McGahn incident, among the many others, again, this attempt by the president to tell McGahn to author some memorandum indicating that the president had never, ever, ever directed the firing of the special counsel in this case. You have to believe that Bob Mueller today would look back on that and say, once again, a misstatement of fact as set forth in this memorandum, a misstatement about what the Mueller report, what the findings of the investigation actually said. And so once again, lots of things like that in this memorandum that are simply misstatements of what Bob Mueller intended. And they seize upon the notion that Bob Mueller himself, because he was prohibited from going ahead with this internal memorandum to make specific findings of guilt, that therefore, they're going to make the choice. The Attorney General makes the determination that Bob Mueller does not. If you read through the second portion of that report, that Mueller report of now 3 years ago, you come to a very different conclusion. And I would offer that anyone who has done that, people on all sides of the political aisle who've done that, came to the conclusion that indeed, if you could have prosecuted a president, there would be a basis for doing it. Also a basis, for what it's worth, to impeach him at the time, a decision made by the United States Congress not to go ahead with any of that. There was a very interesting discussion in the course of this memorandum as well about flipping, about the president's public statements exhorting witnesses like Flynn and Manafort and Stone and Cohen not to flip, and that the suggestion was in Mueller's report that those should be viewed as obstruction of justice, that the report itself makes very clear that this was an attempt to intimidate witnesses, to try to get them to describe their engagements with the president in a way that is inconsistent with the facts and therefore also obstruction of justice. The memorandum released this past week goes in just the opposite direction and says once again that these public statements of the president were just defending himself. Says once again, the conclusion is buttressed by the absence of any real clear evidence that those witnesses had information that would prove the president had committed a crime. The president's public statement could be viewed as efforts to defend himself from public criticism related to the special counsel's investigation or to discourage the witnesses from making what the president believed might be false statements in exchange for a lesser sentence. Bob Mueller has got to look at that and say that is a complete miscodification of what I said. This notion of flipping was just the opposite, that he came to the conclusion that was one of a basis that in a nation, in a Department of Justice, where you would have the authority to prosecute a sitting president, that those events, attempts to subvert, to affect the testimony of people like Paul Manafort and Stone and Cohen and Flynn, Michael Flynn, others, were obstructive in nature and should have been addressed either in the political system, through the impeachment process, or through a criminal prosecution that could have been pursued absent that memorandum. In the end, the memorandum concludes this with this. The special counsel's thorough investigation did not establish that the president committed any underlying crime related to Russian interference. Once again, getting back to this fundamentally erroneous notion that you need to have an underlying crime to accomplish obstruction in the investigation of that crime. As noted, they went on to say, in every successful obstruction case cited in the report, the corrupt acts were undertaken to prevent the investigation prosecution of a separate crime. The existence of such an offense is not a necessary element, they say, which is to their credit, but the absence of underlying guilt. No underlying guilt here, they say, is relevant and powerful evidence in assessing whether otherwise innocent actions were undertaken with a corrupt motive. Novel obstruction theories, they describe this as, no, just the opposite. In Bob Mueller's report, fundamental statements about the law and the facts undermined and discredited by nothing in this memorandum, at least this past week. We'll talk more about this in the second hour this morning on Morning Cannolis, and then we're going to move into the other big document released this past week, which is the affidavit in support of the Mar-a-Lago search and seizure. Join us in the second hour of Morning Cannolis, our review of these big stories coming out of Washington, D.C. just this past week.